previously on the history of America's 1%.
All right, so first off, right out of the gate, we got corporations coming in and settling America. So what's next? They're like, well, I mean, you don't expect us to work the land, do you? Call up the English courts and they're like, hey, man, we need some people. So they pull in the poor people, you know, arrest them, try them, ship them off as criminal debt slaves to the New World. Come on, work in America. It's a big, happy plantation. You know, but that's not enough. Slaves from Africa, from the Dutch. And then they get wives shipped over because, hey, well, you know, it's pretty lonely there in the New World. So the people are coming here and they're pissed off. They're like, well, what's going on, you know? Trying to escape from the economic tyranny in the old country. Spend all my money to get here. Now you're on the shores and you're telling me all the land is gone? But hell, you're a settler. You're broke. What are you going to do? You start working for these people. It's either that or die, I guess. I mean, who are these guys? They're like feudal lords. Dutch people call them patroons. It's just like the old world. They make the laws, they dispense justice. They're the judge, jury, and executioner. You gotta swear a blood oath and fealty to them. So the people are pissed off, and it's the same old thing. You try to keep the power in the hands of the few. It's already starting in the 1600s in America. Well, you want to join the government? All you have to do is own a little property. I was like, how can I have property? I have no money. I barely got to this godforsaken new land. Meanwhile, these fat cats are sitting on estates of, like, hundreds of thousands of acres. The whole state of New York or something like that. Land monopolies.
You get up and howl about America and democracy. There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont. Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today. We no longer live in a world of nations and ideologies. The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome back to another episode from File and Claw Audiobook Archives. This is a further reading of The History of Great American Fortunes by Gustavus Myers, published in 1911 by the Charles H. Kerr and Company of Chicago. And this is a book about the history of wealth formation in America from colonial times to the turn of the 20th century. And now we're already into the second chapter here. It's a long book, so, you know, we're still getting started. There's three volumes. This is volume one, part one, going to be chapter two. And as always, I will be keeping the recording as close as I can to 1 hour for easy digestion and consumption of the material. Also, I will be providing insight as I read, hopefully not too much, hopefully I won't break up the flow of the book too much. Also, I will be offering definitions for, well, archaic words, you know, stuff I have to look up. It's always helpful. And I'll be pointing out footnotes. They will be posted on the website, and you can find that at on Twitter at fileandclaw322 is the handle. The website's changed a few times, so just look for me on Twitter, and then you can go from there. That'll be the latest location of it. But actually, I was kind of poking through the footnotes of Chapter 1, and there's a lot of interesting information. You know, Gustavus Myers in this book, which is freely available online, by the way, I would highly suggest you go download it and take a look at it for yourself. But, you know, the footnotes of the book are not just, he doesn't just cite the document or book or record, you know, public record where he is getting this, these facts, but, he actually writes a little bit more. There's more information in here. Some of these footnotes carry on several pages of the book at the bottom, so I think I'm going to actually read them as an aside if they have, well, if they contain some additional information, because some of them are pretty informative, so I'm going to start doing that from now on. But anyways, we're going to jump right into it. So yeah, this is Chapter 2, The Sway of the Landgraves. While this seizure of land was going on in New Netherlands, vast areas in New England were passing suddenly into the hands of a few men. These areas sometimes comprised what are now entire states, and were often palpably obtained by fraud, collusion, trickery, or favoritism. The Puritan influx into Massachusetts was an admixture of different occupations. Some were traders or merchants, others were mechanics. By far the largest portion were cultivators of the soil, whom economic pressure, not less than religious persecution, had driven from England. To these, land was a paramount consideration. Describing how the English tiller had been expropriated from the soil, Wallace says, quote, "The ingenuity of lawyers and direct landlord legislation steadily increased the powers of great landowners and encroached upon the rights of the people, till at length the monstrous doctrine arose that the landless Englishman has no right whatever to enjoyment even of the unenclosed commons and heaths and the mountain and forest wastes of his native country, but is everywhere in the eye of the law a trespasser whenever he ventures off a public road or pathway." Unquote. Footnote number one. By the 16th century, the English peasantry had been evicted even from the commons, which were turned into sheep walks by the impoverished barons to make money from the Flemish wool market. The land at home wrenched from them, the poor English immigrants ardently expected that in America land would be plentiful. They were bitterly disappointed. The various English companies chartered by royal command with all-inclusive powers, despite the frequent opposition of Parliament, held the trade in land of the greater part of the colonies as a rigid monopoly. In the case of the New England Company, severe punishment was threatened to all who should encroach upon its rights. It also was freed from payment for 21 years and was relieved from taxes forever. The colonies carved into great estates. The New England colonies were carved out into a few colossal private estates. The example of the British nobility was emulated, but the chartered companies did not have to resort to the adroit, disingenuous subterranean methods which the English land magnates used in perpetuating their seizure, as so graphically described by S. W. Thackeray, his last name Thackery, in his work The Land in the Community. The land in New England was taken over boldly and arbitrarily by the directors of the Plymouth Company, the most powerful of all the companies which exploited New England. The handful of men who participated in this division sustained with a high hand their claims and pretensions, and augmented and fortified them by every device, quite regardless of who the changing monarch was or what country ruled. These colonial magnates generally contrived to keep the power strong in their own hands. There might be a superficial show of changed conditions, an apparent infusion of democracy, but in reality the substance remained the same. This was nowhere more lucidly or strikingly illustrated than after New Netherlands passed into the control of the English and was renamed New York. Laws were decreed which seemed to bear the impress of justice and democracy. Monopoly was abolished. Every man was given the much-prized right of trading in furs and pelts, and the burgher right was extended and its acquisition made easier. However well-intentioned these altered laws were, they turned out to be shallow delusions. Under English rule, the gifts of vast estates in New York were even greater than under Dutch rule, and beyond doubt were granted corruptly or by favoritism. Miles upon miles of land in New York, which had not been preempted, were brazenly given away by the royal governor Fletcher for bribes, and his last name is Fletcher. And it was suspected, although not clearly proved, that he trafficked in estates in Pennsylvania during the time when by royal order he supplanted William Penn in the government of that province. From the evidence which has come down, it would appear that anyone who offered Fletcher his price could be transformed into a great vested landowner. But still the people imagined that they had a real democratic government. Had not England established representative assemblies? These, with certain restrictions, alone had the power of lawmaking for the provinces. These representative bodies were supposed to rest upon the vote of the people, which vote, however, was determined by a strict property qualification. So there you go. Again, you have representative bodies, but hey, you have to own a crap ton of land to be involved with those. And I'm guessing, as we heard in the last chapter, that most of the poor people who came here hardly had a penny to their name, and so I doubt they owned any land. Continuing on with the book here, the landed proprietors, the political rulers. What really happened was that, apparently deprived of direct feudal power, the landed interests had no difficulty in retaining their law-making ascendancy by getting control of the various provincial assemblies. Bodies supposedly representative of the whole people were, in fact, composed of great landowners, of a quota of merchants who were subservient to the landowners, and a sprinkling of farmers. In Virginia, the state was long continuing, while in New York province it became such an intolerable abuse and resulted in such oppressions to the body of people that on September 20th, 1764, Lieutenant Governor Cadwallader Colden, his name C-A-D-W-A-L-L-A-D-R, Cadwallader, last name Colden, C-O-L-D-E-N, writing from New York to the Lords of Trade at London, strongly expostulated. He described how the land magnates had devised to set themselves up as the law-making class. Three of the large land grants contained provisions guaranteeing to each owner the privilege of sending a representative to the General Assembly. These landed proprietors, therefore, became hereditary legislators. Quote, the owners of other great patents, unquote, Colden continued, quote, being men of the greatest opulence in the several American counties where these tracts are, have sufficient influence to be perpetually elected for those counties. The General Assembly, then, of this province consists of the owners of these extravagant grants, the merchants of New York, the principal of them, strongly connected with the owners of the great tracts by family interest, and of common farmers, which last are men easily deluded and led away with popular arguments of liberty and privileges. The proprietors of the great tracts are not only freed from the quitrents which the other landholders in the provinces pay, but by their influences in the assembly are freed from every other public tax on their lands. Unquote. Footnote number 2. What Colden wrote of the landed class of New York was substantially true of all the other provinces. The small, powerful clique of great landowners had cunningly taken over to themselves the functions of government and diverted them to their own ends. First the land was seized, and then it was declared exempt of taxation. Inevitably there was but one sequel. Everywhere, but especially so in New York and Virginia, the landed proprietors became richer and more arrogant, while poverty, even in the new country with extraordinary resources, took root and continued to grow. The burden of taxation fell entirely upon the farming and laboring classes. Although the merchants were nominally taxed, they easily shifted their obligations upon those two classes by indirect means of trade. Usurious loans and mortgages became prevalent. So yeah, just like I said, there you go. High taxation and debt. Right away in America, high taxation and debt are two greatest traditions. It was now seen what meaningless tinsel the unrestricted right to trade in furs was. To get the furs, access to land was necessary, and the land was monopolized. In the South, where tobacco and corn were the important staples, the worker was likewise denied the soil except as a laborer or tenant. And in Massachusetts colony, where fortunes were being made from timber, furs, and fisheries, the poor man had practically no chance against the superior advantages of the landed and privileged class. These conditions led to severe reprisals. Several uprisings in New York, Bacon's Rebellion in Virginia, after the restoration of Charles II, when that king granted large tracts of land belonging to the colony to his favorites, and subsequently, in 1734, a ferment in Georgia, even under the mild proprietary rule of the philanthropist Oglethorpe, his last name O-G-L-E-T-H-O-R-P-E, were all really outbursts of popular discontent, largely against the oppressive form in which land was held and against discriminative taxation, although each uprising had its local issues differing from those elsewhere. In this conflict between landed class and people, the only hope of the mass of the people lay in getting the favorable attention of royal governors. At least one of these considered earnestly and conscientiously the grave existing abuses and responded to popular protest which had become bitter. A conflict between land magnates and people. This official was the Earl of Bellomont, and that's spelled Earl, of course, E-A-R-L, and Bellomont, B-E-L-L-O-M-O-N-T. Scarcely had he arrived after his appointment as Captain General and Governor of Massachusetts Bay, New York, and other provinces, when he was made acquainted with the widespread discontent. The landed magnates had not only created an abysmal difference between themselves and the masses in possessions and privileges, but also in dress and air founded upon strict distinctions and law. The landed aristocrat with his laces and ruffles, his silks and his gold and silver ornaments, and his expensive tableware, his consciously superior air and tone of grandiose authority, was far removed in established position from the mechanic or the laborer with his coarse clothes and mean habitation. Laws were long in force in various provinces which prohibited the common people from wearing gold and silver lace, silks, and ornaments. Bellomont noted the sense of deep injustice smoldering in the minds of the people and set out to confiscate the great estates, particularly, as he set forth, as many of them had been obtained by bribery. It was with amazement that Bellomont learned that one man, Colonel Samuel Allen, his last name is Allen, A-L-L-E-N, had claimed to own the whole of what is now the state of New Hampshire. When, in 1635, the Plymouth colony was about to surrender its charter, its directors apportioned their territory to themselves individually. New Hampshire went by lot to Captain John Mason, last name M-A-S-O-N, who some years before had obtained a patent to the same area from the company. Charles I had confirmed the company's action after Mason's death. His claims were bought up by Allen for about $1,250. Mason, however, left an heir, and protracted litigation followed. In the meantime, settlers, taking advantage of these conflicting claims, proceeded to spread over New Hampshire and hew the forest for cleared agricultural land. Allen managed to get himself appointed governor of New Hampshire in 1692, and declared the whole province his personal property and threatened to oust the settlers as trespassers unless they came to terms. There was imminent danger of an uprising of the settlers, who failed to see why the land upon which they had spent labor did not belong to them. Bellomont investigated and, in communication dated June 22, 1700, to the Lords of Trade, denounced Allen's title as defective and insufficient, and brought out the charge that Allen had tried to get his confirmation of his, Allen's, claims by means of a heavy bribe. Attempted bribery charged. There was an offer made of me, Bellomont wrote, quote, of £10,000 in money, but I thank God I had not the least tempting thought to accept of the offer, and I hope nothing in this world will ever be able to attempt me to betray England in the least degree. This offer was made me 3 or 4 times, unquote. Bellomont added, quote, I will make it appear that the lands and woods claimed by Colonel Allen are much more valuable than 10 of the biggest estates in England, and I will rate those 10 estates at £300,000 apiece, one with another, which is 3 millions. By his own confession to me at Piscataway last summer, he valued the quit rents of his lands, as he calls them, at £22,000 per annum, at 3d per acre of 6d in the pound of all improved rents. Then I leave your lordships to judge what an immense estate the improved rents must be, which, if his title be allowed, he has as good a right to the aforementioned quitrents, and all this besides the woods, which I believe he might very well value at half the worth of the lands. There never was, I believe, since the world began, so great a bargain as Allen has had of Mason, if it be allowed to stand good, that all this vast estate I have been naming should be purchased for a poor £250, and that a desperate debt, too, as Colonel Allen thought, He pretends to a great part of this province as far westward as Cape St. Anne, which is said to take in 17 of the best towns in this province next to Boston, the best improved land, and I think Colonel Allen told me, 800,000 or 900,000 acres of their land. If Colonel Allen shall at any time go about to make a forcible entry on these lands, he pretends to, for to be sure the people will never turn tenants to him willingly. The present occupants will resist him by any force he shall bring, and the province will be put to a combustion, and what may be the course I dread to think. Unquote. Footnote number 3. But the persistent Allen did not establish his claim. Several times he lost in litigation, the last time in 1715. His death was followed by his son's death, and after 60 years of fierce animosities and litigation, the whole contention was allowed to lapse. Says Lodge, quote, "His heirs were minors who did not push the controversy, and the claim soon sank out of sight to the great relief of the New Hampshire people, whose right to their homes had so long been in question." Unquote. Footnote number 4. Similarly, another area, the entirety of what is now the state of Maine, went to the individual ownership of Sir Fernandino Gorges. Oh gosh, I'd better spell his name. F-E-R-N-A-N-D-I-N-O, Fernandino. Last name Gorges, I'm guessing that's how it's pronounced, but that's G-O-R-G-E-S. Similarly, another area, the entirety of what is now the state of Maine, went to the individual ownership of Sir Fernandino Gorges, the same who had betrayed Essex to Queen Elizabeth and who had received rich rewards for his treachery. Footnote number 5. And in this footnote, Gus Myers makes a little note here I'm going to read about Fernandino Gorges. He says, "Yet this fortune seeker, who had incurred the contempt of every noble English mind, is described by one of the class of power-worshipping historians as follows, quote, "Fame and wealth, so often the idols of superior intellect, were the prominent objects of this aspiring man." Unquote. Continuing on with the book, the domain descended to his grandson, Fernando Gorges. His first name, F-E-R-N-A-N-D-O, Fernando. Last name same as his father, of course. Who, on March 13th, 1677, sold it by deed to John Usher, last name U-S-H-E-R, a Boston merchant, for £1,250. The ominous dissatisfaction of the New Hampshire and other settlers with the monopolization of land was not slighted by the English government. At the very time Usher bought Maine, the government was on the point of doing the same thing and opening the land for settlement. Usher at once gave a deed of the province to the Governor and Company of Massachusetts, of which colony and later state it remained a part until its creation as a state in 1820, and footnote number 6. These were two notable instances of vast land grants which reverted to the people. In most of the colonies, the popular outcry for free access to the land was not so effective. In Pennsylvania, after the government was restored to Penn, and in part of New Jersey, conditions were more favorable to the settlers. In those colonies, corrupt usurpations of the land were comparatively few, although the proprietary families continued to hold extensive tracts. Penn's sons, by his second wife, for instance, became men of great wealth. Footnote number 7. And in that footnote, Gus Myers notes here that the sons of William Penn by his second wife, their claim to inherit proprietary rights was bought at the time of the Revolutionary War by the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania for £130,000, or about $580,000. So yeah, that would probably make them pretty wealthy. The Pacific and Conciliatory Quaker faith operated as a check on any local extraordinary misuse of power. Unfortunately for historical accuracy and penetration, there is an obscurity as to the intimate circumstances under which many of the large private estates in the South were obtained. The general facts as to their grants, of course, are well known, but the same specific underlying details, such as may be disinterred from Bellomont's correspondence, are lacking. In New York, at least, and presumably during Fletcher's sway of government in Pennsylvania, great land grants went for bribes. This is definitely brought out in Bellomont's official communications. Vast estates secured by bribery. Fletcher, it would seem, had carried on a brisk traffic in creating by a stroke of the quill powerfully rich families by simply granting them domains in return for bribes. You know, it's so funny, it seems like in this book, just as an aside, I mean, what he's talking about right now, you really don't hear a lot about that, you know, the founding of different states. It's, oh yeah, the companies come in, you know, and then they're settlers, and then they wanted freedoms, and this and that, but you don't hear a lot about these guys who are like, who own the whole state of New Hampshire, or they own the whole state of Maine. You know, you really just don't hear about that. Or this guy, he owns like all of New York or a huge chunk of the state of New York. In the last chapter, he talked about Van Rensselaer, yeah. So, you know, that's something I gotta admit that maybe they do talk about it, but it wasn't taught to me in school, you know. Like, hey, these guys, they came in, got massive chunks of land, just single people after the companies dissolved or whatever. That's something to ponder upon. Let's get back to the book here. Captain John R. N. Evans, last name E-V-A-N-S, had been in command of the Royal Warship Richmond. An estate was his fervent ambition. Fletcher's mandate gave him a grant of land running 40 miles one way and 30 another on the west bank of the Hudson, beginning at the south line of the present town of New Paltry, Ulster County. It included the southern tier of the now existing towns in that picturesque county, two-thirds of the fertile undulations of Orange County, and a part of the present town of Haverstraw. It is related of this area that there was, quote, but one house on it, or rather a hut, where a poor man lives, unquote. Notwithstanding this lone, solitary subject, Evans saw great trading and seigneurial possibilities in his tract. And what did he pay for this immense stretch of territory? A very modest bribe. Common report had it that he gave Fletcher £100 for the grant. Footnote number 8. Nicholas Bayard, last name B-A-Y-A-R-D, of whom it is told that he was a handy go-between in arranging with the sea pirates the price that they should pay for Fletcher's protection, was another favored personage. Bayard was the recipient of a grant 40 miles long and 30 broad on both sides of Scorey Creek. Colonel William Smith's prize was a grant from Fletcher of an estate 50 miles in length on Nassau, now Long Island. According to Bellomont, Smith got this land, quote, arbitrarily and by strong hand, unquote. Smith was in collusion with Fletcher and, moreover, was chief justice of the province, quote, a place of great awe as well as authority, unquote. This judicial land wrester forced the town of Southampton to accept the insignificant sum of £10 for the greater part of 40 miles of beach, a singularly profitable transaction for Smith, who cleared in 1 year £500, the proceeds of whales taken there, as he admitted to Bellomont. Footnote number 9. Henry Beekman, his last name, Beekman, B-E-E-K-M-A-N. The astute and smooth founder of a rich and powerful family, was made a magnate of the first importance by a grant from Fletcher of a tract 16 miles in length in Dutchess County, and also of another estate running 20 miles along the Hudson and 8 miles inland. This estate he valued at £5,000. Footnote number 10. Likewise, Peter Schuyler, Godfrey, Delius, and their associates had conjointly secured by Fletcher's patent a grant 50 miles long in the romantic Mohawk Valley, a grant which, quote, the Mohawk Indians have often complained of, unquote. And those guys' names, Schuyler, it's S-C-H-U-Y-L-E-R. Godfrey, his name, G-O-D-F-R-E-Y, and Delius, D-E-L-L-I-U-S. Back to the book here. Upon this estate, they placed a value of $25,000. This was a towering fortune for the period in its actual command of labor necessities, comforts, and luxuries. It ranked as a power of transcending importance. These were some of the biggest estate created by, quote, Colonel Fletcher's intolerable, corrupt, selling away the lands of this province, unquote, as Bellomont termed it in his communication to the Lords of Trade of November 28, 1700. Fletcher, it was set forth, profited richly by these corrupt grants. He got in bribes, it was charged, at least £4,000. Footnote number 11. And just as an aside in this footnote, Gus Myers makes mention that one of Bellomont's chief complaints was that the landgraves monopolized the timber supply. He recommended the passage of a law vesting in the king the right to all trees, such as were fit for masts of ships, or for other use in building ships of war. Yeah, there you go. Back to the book here. But Fletcher was not the only corrupt official. In his interesting work on the Times, footnote number 12, George W. Schuyler presents what is an undoubtedly accurate description of how Robert Livingston, last name Livingston, progenitor of a rich and potent family which for generations exercised a profound influence in politics and other public affairs, contrived to get together an estate which soon ranked as the second largest in New York State and as one of the greatest in the colonies. Livingstone was the younger son of a poor exile clergyman. In currying favor with one official after another, he was unscrupulous, dexterous, and adaptable. He invariably changed his politics with the change of administration. In less than a year after his arrival, he was appointed to an office which yielded him a good income. This office he held for nearly half a century and simultaneously was the incumbent of other lucrative posts. Offices were created by Governor Dongan, last name D-O-N-G-A-N, apparently for his sole benefit. His passion was to get together an estate which would equal the largest. Extremely penurious, he loaned money at frightfully usurious rates and hounded his victims without a vestige of sympathy. Footnote number 13. And just in this footnote, real quick, Gus Myers says that according to Reynolds' Albany Chronicles, Livingston was in collusion with Captain Kidd, the sea pirate. Reynolds also tells that Livingston loaned money at 10%. Also, I had to look up the word penurious, and that means extremely stingy or parsimonious or miserly, so you know, you get the idea. Let's get back to the book now and continue here with Gus Myers's The History of Great American Fortunes. I'm pretty sure we were talking about, who was this? Robert Livingston. As a trader and government contractor, he made enormous profits. Such was his cohesive collusion with high officials that competitors found it impossible to outdo him. A current saying of him was that he made a fortune by pinching the bellies of the soldiers. That is, as an army contractor who defrauded in quantity and quality of supplies. I hate to stop again, but you know what? That's such a good, pinching the bellies of the soldiers. That's in quotes. And you know what? That has been going on for so long, you know. There's, during the Civil War, there are people who've sold, I'm pretty sure it's Civil War. And I'm thinking the Civil War where they had a guy who would like follow around the troops as they moved and sold them crappy gear. It was just terrible, you know, it wasn't worth a damn. Then they had, like in Vietnam, I remember they had a ton of problems with the machine guns and they would jam all the time and they're, you know, just garbage, and there was a big thing about that and how it was getting soldiers killed during the Vietnam conflict. And then, finally, I think of, like, present day and the endless conflicts that currently rage in our society. In Iraq and Afghanistan, there was all these articles that came out during that time about soldiers who were not receiving enough body armor, and the Humvees had faulty armor in them, and soldiers were getting killed by IEDs, and there were contractors like Halliburton who were doing shoddy electrical work and all kinds of stuff in the rebuilding of Iraq. And so, you know what, we think this like, oh my gosh, these guys, what are they doing? You know, why are they doing this? No, it's, you know, it's like an old time thing. They're just pinching the bellies of the soldiers, as Gus Myers writes here of Robert Livingston all the way back in, I don't know exactly when this was. He says he dies in 1728, so this is like gotta be the early 1700s or late 1600s. You know, these guys were doing it all the way back then, so, you know, what are you expecting? Really? I mean, you're expecting this stuff to change? Come on. Ugh, I want to get back to the book. I'll try not to interrupt anymore. Sorry, I don't know, it just seems so obvious, like, to see this stuff happening over and over. But you wouldn't know unless you read these old, dusty, forgotten, or suppressed books. Back to the book here, he's talking about Robert Livingston. By a multitude of underhand and ignoble artifices, he finally found himself the lord of a manor 16 miles long and 24 broad. On this estate, he built flour and sawmills, a bakery, and a brewery. In his advanced old age, he exhibited great piety, but held on grimly to every shilling that he could and as long as he could. When he died about 1728, the exact date is unknown, at the age of 74 years, he left an estate which was considered of such colossal value that its true value was concealed for fear of further enraging the discontented people. Effects of the land seizures. The seizure of these vast estates and the arbitrary exclusion of the many from the land produced a combustible situation. An instantaneous and distinct cleavage of class divisions was the result. Entrenched in their possessions, the landed class looked down with haughty disdain upon the farming and laboring classes. On the other hand, the farm laborer, with his 16 hours work a day for a 40-cent wage, the carpenter straining for his 52 cents a day, the shoemaker drudging for his 73 cents a day, and the blacksmith for his 70 cents, footnote number 14, thought over this injustice as they bent over their tasks. And, just as an aside, in this footnote here, number 14, Gus Myers says that the New York colonial documents relate that in 1699, in the three provinces of Bellomont's jurisdiction, quote, the laboring man received 3 shillings a day, which was considered dear, unquote. Back to the book here. They could sweat through their lifetime at honest labor, producing something of value, and yet be a constant prey to poverty, while a few men, by means of bribes, had possessed themselves of estates worth tens of thousands of pounds, and had preempted great stretches of the available lands. In consulting extant historical works, it is noticeable that they give but the merest shadowy glimpse of this intense bitterness, of what were called the lower classes, and of the incessant struggle now raging, now smoldering between the landed aristocracy and the common people. Contrary to the roseate descriptions often given of the independent position of the settlers at that time, it was a time when the use and misuse of law brought about sharp divisions of class lines, which arose from artificially created inequalities, economically and politically. With the great landed estates came tenantry, wage slavery, and chattel slavery, the one condition, the natural generator of the others. The rebellious tendency of the poor colonists against becoming tenants and the usurpation of the land were clearly brought out by Bellomont in a letter written on November 28, 1700, to the Lords of Trade. He complained that, quote, "People are so cramped here for want of land that several families within my own knowledge and observation are removed to the new country, a name they give to Pennsylvania and the Jerseys, for, to use Mr. Graham's expression to me, and that often repeated too, what man will be such a fool as to become a base tenant to Mr. Delius, Colonel Scheuer, Mr. Livingston, and so he ran through the whole of our mighty landgraves. When for crossing Hudson's River, that man can, for a song, purchase a good freehold in the Jerseys." Unquote. If the immigrant happened to be able to muster a sufficient sum, he could, indeed, become an independent agriculturist in New Jersey and in parts of Pennsylvania, and provide himself with the tools of trade. But many immigrants landed with empty pockets, and became laborers dependent upon the favor of the landed proprietors. As for the artisans, the carpenters, masons, tailors, blacksmiths, they either kept to the cities and towns where their trade principally lay, or bonded themselves to the lords of the manors. Attempt at confiscation thwarted. Bellomont fully understood the serious evils which had been injected into the body politic, and strongly applied himself to the task of confiscating the great estates. One of his first proposals was to urge upon the Lords of Trade the restriction of all governors throughout the colonies from granting more than 1,000 acres to any man without leave from the king, and putting a quitrent of 50 crowns on every 100 acres, this sum to go to the royal treasury. This suggestion was not acted upon. He next attacked the Assembly of New York and called upon it to annul the great grants. In doing this, he found that the most powerful members of the Assembly were themselves the great landowners, and were putting obstacle after obstacle in his path. After great exertions, he finally prevailed upon the Assembly to vacate at least 2 of the grants, those to Evans and Bayard. The Assembly did this probably as a sop to Bellomont and to public opinion, and because Evans and Bayard had lesser influence than the other landed functionaries. But the owners of the other estates tenaciously held them intact. The people regarded Bellomont as a sincere and ardent reformer, but the landed men and their following abused him as a meddler and destructionist. Alright, that's a good time to come in here. Because you know what, see, this is one of the things in the book. I just want to point out here that Gus Myers is going to talk pretty glowingly about the Earl of Bellomont. And it's true, you know, he's saying, like, hey, these guys are corrupt, they're taking bribes, they're seizing land, they are ripping off and oppressing the laborers who are working for them and making them these great fortunes. But you gotta look to this to see, this is like the bias slant type thing. At the same time, he's doing this, all he's really saying is that, hey, we should get this land back for the crown, or, hey, the crown should, the king should get a little cut of this, or, you know, he should, he can give out the land, but, hey, we need the trees and stuff. That should all go to the king, or he should get a cut of the profits from the furs and, this and that. The fisheries, the whales, you know. He wants to break up these great land trusts simply to give them back to the king, or to, you know, get the profits from, now let's just say a cut. He wants a cut, man. He's like Vinny, you know, Vinny from the mob. He wants a cut. That's pretty much, what Belmont's doing, you know, what he talks about. Hey, the problem is with timber. The king should have the timber. Not like the people should have it. So, you know, you gotta kinda, yeah, Belmont's, you know, he's, the people may have considered him an ardent reformer, but look who he's shrugging for in the background. It's the king, and it's not like the monarchy of England had such a great reputation as treating the poor Englishman fair. I mean, that's the whole reason why he's coming over here. He's like, hey, you know, things are so terrible back in the old country. The economic forces are pushing me out here. And then they get here, and it's the same damn thing. And so it's like a catch-22, and this guy's like, you know, he's in there to get a piece of the pie, essentially. That's my take on it. I know Gus Myers, really likes to, you know, he goes on like, oh, he's a reformer, he's doing this and that. He was, but you gotta kinda look beyond, you know, what he was doing. But anyways, let's get back to the book here. And, yeah, just remember here what, he was talking about Belmont trying to break up the corrupt land grants and, appealing to the assembly, but finding that, hey, the people who own all the land were running the representative assemblies, quote-unquote. So anyways, continuing now with the book. Despairing of getting a self-interested assembly to act, Belmont appealed to the Lords of Trade. Quote, if your lordships mean I shall go on to break the rest of the extravagant grants of land by Colonel Fletcher, or other governors by act of assembly, I shall stand in need of a peremptory order from the king to do so, unquote. Footnote number 15. A month later, he insisted to his superiors at home that if they intended that the corrupt and extravagant grant should be confiscated, quote, which I will be bold to say by all the rules of reason and justice ought to be done, I believe it must be done by an act of Parliament in England, for I am a little jealous I shall not have strength enough in the Assembly of New York to break them. Unquote. The majority of this body, he pointed out, were landed men, and when their own interest was touched, they declined to act contrary to it. Unless, added Belmont, quote, the power of the Palatines, Smith, Livingston, the Phillips, father and son, footnote number 16, and six or seven more were reduced, the country is ruined, unquote, footnote number 17. And let's see, the footnote, well, God, let me spell the names first. He says, the Palatines, that's P-A-L-A-T-I-N-E-S, Smith, Livingston, we got that. The Phillips, that was the last family he named, that's P-H-I-L-L-I-P-S. The father and son of that, he has a footnote here, and Gustavus Myers writes in the footnote that Frederick and his son Adolphus were the father and son. Frederick was the employer of the pirate Captain Samuel Burgess, his last name B-U-R-G-E-S-S, of New York, who at first was sent out by Phillips to Madagascar to trade with the pirates, and who then turned pirate himself. From the first voyage, Phillips and Burgess cleared together £5,000, the proceeds of trade and slaves. The second voyage yielded £10,000 and 300 slaves. Burgess married a relative of Philip's and continued piracy, but was caught and imprisoned in Newgate. Philip spent great sums of money to save him, and succeeded. Burgess resumed piracy and met death from poisoning in Africa while engaged in carrying off slaves. And all that was from The Lives and Bloody Exploits of the Most Noted Pirates, page 177 to 183. And Gus Meyer, he notes about the book that this work was a serious study of the different sea pirates. So, there you go. There's also another footnote in there, footnote number 17 at the end about the country being ruined. Gus Myers notes that on November 27, 1700, Bellomont wrote to the Lords of the Treasury, quote, "I can supply the king and all his dominions with naval stores, except flax and hemp, from this province and New Hampshire. But then your lordships and the rest of the ministers must break through Colonel Fletcher's most corrupt grants of all the lands and woods of this province, which I think is the most impudent villainy I ever heard or read of any man." Unquote. So, he's saying like, hey, there's a ton of resources here. Just break up this corrupt grants and I can give them back to you again. That goes back to my point I was making that, you know, Bellomont, sure, he wants to break up these, you know, big monopoly landholders, but, well, you know, who's he really working for? Again, at the end of the day, it is the King of England, and I doubt he's going to just give all that stuff to the poor Englishmen who are slaving away there. Yeah, so anyways, back to the book here. Despite some occasional breaches in its entrenchments, the landocracy continued to rule everywhere, with a high hand, its power as a whole, unbroken. How the Lords of the Soil Lived. A glancing picture of one of these landed proprietors will show the manner in which they lived and what was then accounted their luxury. As one of the quote-unquote foremost men of his day in the colonies, Colonel Smith lived in befitting style. This stern, bushy-eyed man who robbed the community of a vast tract of land and who, as Chief Justice, was inflexibly severe in dealing punishment to petty criminals, and ever vigilant in upholding the rights of property, was Lord of the Manor of St. George, Suffolk County. The finest silks and lace covered his judicial person, his embroidered belt costing 110 pounds at once attested to his great wealth and high station. He had the extraordinary number of 104 silver buttons to adorn his clothing. When he walked, a heavy silver cane supported him, and he rode on a fancy velvet saddle. His three swords were of the finest make. Occasionally he affected a Turkish scimitar. Few watches in the colonies could compare with his massive silver watch. His table was embellished with heavy silver plate, valued at 150 pounds, on which his coat of arms was engraved. 12 Negro slaves responded to his nod. He had a large corps of bounded apprentices and dependent laborers. His mansion looked down on 20 acres of wheat and 20 of corn. And as for his horses and cattle, they were the envy of the country. In his last year, 30 horses were his, 14 oxen, 60 steers, 48 cows, and 2 bulls. Footnote number 18. He lived high, drank, swore, cheated, and administered justice. One of the best and most intimate descriptions of a somewhat contemporaneous landed magnate in the South is that given of Robert Carter, a Virginia planter by Philip Vickers Fithian. And his name is Philip, P-H-I-L-I-P, middle name Vickers, V-I-C-K-E-R-S, last name Fithian, F-I-T-H-I-A-N. A tutor, also there's footnote number 19 there, I don't know if I said that, but we'll get that in there. Philip Vickers Fithian, a tutor in Carter's family. Carter came to his estate from his grandfather, whose land and other possessions were looked upon as so extensive that he was called King Carter. Robert Carter luxuriated in Nominee Hall, a great colonial mansion in Westmoreland County. It was built between 1725 and 1732 of brick covered with strong mortar, which imparted a perfectly white exterior, and was 76 feet long and 40 wide. The interior was one of unusual splendor for the time, such as only the very rich could afford. There were 8 large rooms, one of which was a ballroom 30 feet long. Carter spent most of his leisure hours cultivating the study of law and of music. His library contained 1,500 volumes, and he had a varied assortment of musical instruments. He was the owner of 60,000 acres of land spread over almost every county of Virginia, and he was the master of 600 Negro slaves. The greater part of a prosperous ironworks near Baltimore was owned by him, and near his mansion he built a flour mill, equipped to turn out 25,000 bushels of wheat a year. Carter was not only one of the big planters, but one of the big capitalists of the age. All that he had to do was to exercise a general supervision. His overseers saw to the running of his various industries. Like the other large landholders, he was one of the active governing class. As a member of the provincial council, he had great influence in the making of laws. He was a thorough gentleman, we are told, and took good care of his slaves and of his white laborers, who were grouped in workhouses and little cottages within range of his mansion. Within his domain, he exercised a sort of benevolent despotism. He was one of the first few to see that chattel slavery could not compete in efficiency with white labor, and he reckoned that more money could be made from the white laborer, for whom no responsibility of shelter, clothing, food, and attendance had to be assumed, than from the Negro slave, whose sickness, disability, or death entailed direct financial loss. Wow, that is interesting. So he's saying that this guy saw that, yeah, you can own slaves, but if they get sick, they get hurt, they die for whatever reason, you lose money. Whereas the wage laborer, you know, if it doesn't show up, oh well, not your fault, you don't have to give him any food. He shows up on his own, he buys his own food, provides his own shelter, and he pays for his own clothing. You know, that's very interesting thing. Nobody talks about that, but that is an interesting point. And look how, quote unquote, slavery, and with all due respect to anybody who's ever worn, you know, chains, of course, you know, that's a terrible situation, but it's kind of evolved now from being owned property and to wage labor. Look at everybody now, wage labor. Credit card debt. That is a form of slavery. Believe it. Getting back to the book here. Before his death, he emancipated a number of his slaves. This, in brief, is the rather flattering depiction of one of the conspicuously rich planters of the South. The nascent trading class. Land continued to be the chief source of the wealth of the rich until after the Revolution. The discriminative laws enacted by England had held down the progress of the trading class. These laws overthrown, the traders rose rapidly from a subordinate position to the supreme class in point of wealth. No close research into pre-revolutionary currents and movements is necessary to understand that the revolution was brought about by the dissatisfied trading class as the only means of securing absolute freedom of trade. Notwithstanding the view often presented that it was an altruistic movement for the freedom of man, it was essentially an economic struggle fathered by the trading class and by a part of the landed interests. Yeah, he's saying, you know, hey, look, these guys are founding fathers. They were businessmen and landowners and traders from Boston and places like that. And that's mainline history. You can go look that up. Everybody likes to paint it as what did Gus call it? An altruistic movement for the freedom of man. But these guys were big economic players who were getting shut down at every corner, and they were the fathers of the revolution, so make of that what you will. Continuing on with the book, Admixed was a sincere aim to establish free political conditions. This, however, was not an aim for the benefit of all classes, but merely one for the better interests of the propertied class. The poverty-stricken soldiers who fought for their cause found, after the war, that the machinery of government was devised to shut out manhood suffrage and keep the power intact in the hands of the rich. Had it not been for radicals such as Jefferson, Paine, and others, it is doubtful whether such concessions as were made to the people would have been made. The long struggle in various states for manhood suffrage sufficiently attests the deliberate aims of the propertied interest to concentrate in their own hands, and in that of a following favorable to them, the voting power of the government and of the states. With the success of the revolution, the trading class bounded to the first rank. Entail and primogeniture were abolished, and the great estates gradually melted away. For more than a century and a half, the landed interests had dominated the social and political arena. As an acknowledged continuous organization, they ceased to exist. Great estates no longer passed unimpaired from generation to generation, surviving as a distinct entity throughout all changes. They perforce were partitioned among all the children, and through the vicissitudes of subsequent years, passed bit by bit into many hands. Altered laws caused a gradual disintegration in the case of individual holdings, but brought no change in instances of corporate ownership. The Trinity Corporation of New York City, for example, has held on to the vast estate which it was given before the Revolution, except such parts as it has voluntarily sold. Disintegration of the great estates. The individual magnate, however, had no choice. He could no longer entail his estates. Thus, estates which were very large before the Revolution, and which were regarded with astonishment, ceased to exist. The landed interests, however, remained paramount for several decades after the Revolution by reason of the acceleration which long possession and its profits had given them. Washington's fortune, amounting at his death to $530,000, was one of the largest in the county and consisted mainly of land. He owned 9,744 acres, valued at $10 an acre on the Ohio River in Virginia, 3,075 acres worth $200,000 on the Great Kanawha, and also land elsewhere in Virginia and in Maryland, Pennsylvania, New York, Kentucky, the city of Washington, and other places. Footnote number 20. About half a century later, it was only by persistent gatherings of public contributions that his very home was saved to the nation. So had his estate become divided and run down. After a long career, Benjamin Franklin acquired what was considered a large fortune. But it did not come from manufacture or invention, which he did so much to encourage, but from land. His estate in 1788, 2 years before his death, was estimated to be worth $150,000, mostly in land. Footnote number 21. By the opening decades of the 19th century, few of the great estates in New York remained. One of the last of the patroons was Stefan von Rensselaer, who died at the age of 75 on January 26, 1839. Leaving 10 children. Up to this time, the manor had devolved upon the eldest son, although it had been diminished somewhat by various sessions, it was still of great extent. The property was divided among the 10 children, and according to Schuyler, quote, in less than 50 years after his death, the 700,000 acres originally in the manor were in the hands of strangers, unquote. Footnote 22. Long before old Van Rensselaer passed away, he had seen the rise and growth of the trading and manufacturing class, and a new form of landed aristocracy, and he observed with a haughty bitterness how, in point of wealth and power, they far overshadowed the well-nigh defunct old feudal aristocracy. A few hundred thousand dollars no longer was the summit of a great fortune. The age of the millionaire had come. The lordly, leisurely environment of the old landed class had been supplanted by feverish trading and industrial activity which imposed upon society its own newer standards, doctrines, and ideals, and made them uppermost factors. So there you go. Chapter 2 in the books, and I realize that ran a little long there, but hey, there's a lot of good info in there, especially at the end. That is very interesting. A couple things there to note. Washington, Franklin, these guys were big landowners. And, shockingly, this guy Van Rensselaer, he says within 50 years of his death, the 700,000 acres originally in the manor. So that was 1839, so in 1839, in this country, he still owned 700,000 acres. Is that what Gus is saying? Or I guess that's from Schuyler. Yeah, wow. That's just insane that in 1839, think about that. That's like approaching the Civil War. I mean, we're getting up there in time. That's a couple decades away. But yeah, that's, they still had land magnates with 700,000 acres. That boggles my mind. And remember, here's the big guy up in New York, and there's still a county in New York named after him. Van Rensselaer County, or Rensselaer County, I believe. So yeah, ponder on that. Again, join us next time for continued reading of The History of the Great American Fortunes by Gustavus Myers. This is The American History You're Not Supposed to Read, so forget everything you just heard. All